Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. It's a fact. Quality childcare can cost more than tuition at many public colleges. According to the CARE Index, the average cost of full-time care in centers in the U.S. is over $9,500 a year. For many families, sticker shock can mean a struggle to make ends meet and can lead to tough choices. Should childbearing be delayed? Does a parent downsize work and career or leave entirely to provide care? Or perhaps a situation is worked out involving patchwork coverage or an unreliable caregiver. And experts tell us critical brain development happens during the first 3 years of life, so quality care is essential. In the decades since the women's movement, the U.S. has lagged behind many other developed nations in providing options for full-time affordable child care. And at least two Democrats who are running for the White House in 2020 want to change this. Is the lack of affordable quality child care finally winning national attention? Lots to talk about this hour, and we'd like to hear from you. Phones are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joining us this morning are Bridget Schulte, director of the Better Life Lab at New America. Good to have you with us, Bridget.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
And from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., Hannah Matthews is Deputy Executive Director of Policy at the Center for Law and Social Policy. Welcome, Hannah.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So it can cost more to pay for quality child care for an infant or toddler than it does for college tuition for a 17 or 18-year-old. Let's begin with the reasons why. Hannah?
Sure. So absolutely, the child care costs are pretty incredible, as parents know. I want to start with just what we know about childcare, right? So this is a highly skilled task to care for kids, as any parent knows, caring for one child and then managing a classroom of children. And most of those childcare costs are made up of labor or personnel costs. It's about two-thirds of a childcare program's budget. But the ironic thing here is that, in fact, many childcare workers themselves are earning poverty wages. So this is a case where there's just not enough money going into childcare programs to really be able to support the costs. Tuition alone, parent fees, just can't cover the operational costs of childcare. And so we have a problem, which is that childcare programs themselves don't bring in enough money and parents can't pay more.
So college kids and their parents can access loans and grants. You're saying there's not much relief available to the parents of young children.
So we have some programs. The major program, the Federal Child Care and Development Block Grant, is designed to help parents pay for the costs of child care, to help low-income families that are working or going to school pay for those costs, and also to raise the quality of child care. The big problem here is that this program, it's a federal-to-state partnership, and it's never been funded at a level that would support all of those who could benefit from the program. So our latest data shows us that about one in six kids who are in low-income families that would be eligible to get help actually get any support. So we're leaving out about 85% of children in low-income families. So most parents are really, really struggling with the costs.
Some statistics from Pennsylvania, the average family spends nearly 16% of its income on care for just one child, add an infant, and that zooms to 28%. And you know, only about 27% of Pennsylvania families can afford to have infant care. Bridget Schulte, we've been talking just for a moment about low-income families. Are middle-income families seeing sticker shock as well and making some tough choices?
Yeah, I think that it's really important to recognize here that the child care system that we have in the United States isn't working for anyone. Most affects parents at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, no doubt about it. But there are plenty of instances where families of middle, even upper middle class, they're paying more than their mortgage. When we were working on the CARE report, I spent some time in Georgia, and I spent some time with a family who, just to be able to secure a spot in a high-quality childcare center, started paying tuition before the child was even born. Mm. So that tells you that there's not an awful lot of quality care that's available. And they had to try to figure out how to pay a second mortgage, basically, in costs. And I think what's really important to remember here is that when we talk about kind of crazy, outrageous costs of college, and I've got two kids now, about one in college and one about to go, and it's insane. We've been saving since they were babies, and it's still a lot of money. But that's been saving for 18 or 20 years. And if you've got infant care that costs more than that, and you're just at the beginning of starting your career, you haven't had 18 years to save up, you know, we're really putting an incredible burden or expectation on our families that really no other developed country does.
Are you startled then, or perhaps not, by the statistic that a primary reason many young adults are having fewer children or putting off childbearing entirely is the expense of childcare, Bridget?
No, I'm not surprised at all. And I think that that should be a real wake-up call to business leaders, to our policymakers, to presidential candidates. We are in a state of crisis, and we have been. And the fact that we're only now beginning to pay attention to it, I think, on the one hand, I'm glad about that. But this has been a crisis for a long time for all American families. It really is a system that does not work. And part of the reason why, Hannah made a really good point, the market just doesn't work. Early childhood education is like education. We don't expect our K-12 system to be a profitable market. We recognize that that's a public good that we need to invest in. It costs about $12,000 a year to educate a child every year, K-12. But we've decided as a society that that's a good thing to do. We have not made that same decision 0-5. And so we expect parents and families to do it. And it's just, again, it's a market that doesn't work, that needs extra support for it to actually function.
And we're going to talk about some of the proposals on the national political level in a little bit in this show. But I wanted to get briefly too, you know, we're talking about families perhaps with two parents. For single parents, the cost can be even more of a nightmare. Hannah?
That's absolutely right. When we look at the childcare costs as a share of a household budget, it's really quite staggering what families are paying. If we consider families who are under the federal poverty level, now that's just about $21,000 a year, families that pay for childcare are paying on average 30% of their income. Now, the federal government defines childcare affordability as paying no more than 7% of income. So imagine almost a third of your budget going to childcare. For families that are paying that, it means they're making other trade-offs, right? They're thinking about what food they can put on the table. They're perhaps going into debt in other areas. They're making really difficult choices. And for families that simply cannot devote that much of their income to childcare, then they're making lots of tough choices, right? The vast majority of families who have low incomes are actually working. So parents have to go to work. They're finding a way to do that, which means kids may be in lower quality care. It means children may go from one caregiver to another, depending on the day or the hours that a family is working. And that's not good for kids, because we know that kids need stable care. They need to be in quality care, and they need to be with caregivers that are able to support their development themselves.
And not good for parents either, because I'm sure the stress level is through the roof.
Absolutely.
We've got calls and comments coming in already. Shoshana says, my child has special needs and finding a daycare has been impossible. We've been in and out of 5 different daycares and the price has tripled for centers that can attend to my child's needs. Bridget Schulte, another segment of the population which is struggling.
Absolutely. I think that that's a really important point to make, is that parents who have children with special needs are at a real disadvantage. The other thing that we need to think about, too, is parents who have really unpredictable work or work sort of, swing shift or night shift. There's very little that's available for them. And as Hannah mentioned, you know, no matter where you are in the socioeconomic spectrum, you end up falling back oftentimes on family, friends, or neighbors. And sometimes that can be great. You know, grandmom is awesome, and that's a wonderful, loving environment. And sometimes it's not so great, and you're plopped down in front of the television, or it could be even downright dangerous. I think the other thing to remember is, you had mentioned this at the top, these are critical years for laying the brain development for the future. You know, it lays the architecture for all future learning for kids. So you do not want them to be parked in front of a television or in a dangerous situation. I mean, this is our future. And kids need warm, responsive caregivers. They call it serve and return kind of interaction with a caring, loving, and skilled caregiver. This is really, really critical. And we've got so many kids who are in situations that are just below standard. There is a big study that was done looking at quality, and the vast majority of care in this country, because it's a broken system, because we don't invest in it, rated it at mediocre at best, very little high quality, and some of it downright dangerous.
And ironically, perhaps, childcare workers usually don't make that much money. I think this was referenced earlier. The median hourly wage was just over $10 an hour in 2016. So Hannah Matthews, the connection between the importance of child development at that young age and compensating people who are responsible for that hasn't been made.
That's absolutely right. I mean, caregivers are at the heart of this. I think when we talk about childcare quality, we sometimes start with thinking about health and safety standards, which, of course, are important. We want to make sure that children are taken care of and safe. But really, when we really get a little bit deeper and are thinking about children's development, it is the relationship with nurturing and caring adults who have the skills and the knowledge on child development to support kids as they grow and learn. That is the crucial ingredient. And if you think about the fact that the majority of our childcare workforce is making poverty wages and the stress and instability that goes along with that for them, it makes it a really hard job to then support children's development. Mm-hmm. So we should be, as we're thinking about childcare and thinking about affordability for parents, it's actually, we need to make childcare, it should cost more because we actually need to be paying providers a livable wage, which means the only way you can support that is with public funding. And I'm sure we'll talk about that later.
We shall. In the meantime, again, we've got calls and comments coming in. 888-477-9499. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kate says, my husband and I both make $70,000 a year and still struggle with things like our mortgage and child care. Right now, we're spending $1,300 in child care for our son, and I've wondered, should I quit work to save this money? And Bridget Schulte, this is the dilemma families face over and over again.
They really do, and it's a really tough choice. So our families are really stressed financially, stressed in terms of time. And when you look at those gigantic childcare bills, you do have to wonder, would it be better? Over the long run, probably not, but in that short term, it's really a tough decision. And a lot of families are in that position. And frankly, for the families on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, they don't have that choice. They actually do have to drop out just because it's so unavailable or absolutely the cost is just, it's just beyond their ability to pay. So I do really think that we need to be thinking about what are families experiencing and what is that stress doing, not just to families, but also those children for child development.
Got to stop you there for just a moment. Bridget Schulte, director of the Better Life Lab at New America. Hannah Matthews is also with us. She's with the Center for Law and Social Policy. We're talking about the high cost of child care and choices families have to make. And we'll take your calls as well. Stay with us. You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times, and I am Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moskowain. Working families spend a lot of money on child care, and this hour we're talking about the challenges of affording and finding good daycare. Our guests, Hannah Matthews, Deputy Executive Director of Policy at the Center for Law and Social Policy, and Bridget Schulte is Director of the Better Life Lab at New America. And let's start this particular portion of the hour with a telephone call. Haley is in Westchester and joins us live now on Radio Times. Hi, Haley.
Hi, good morning. So starting off, I've got three kids, ages 6 and under. And for a number of years, we've had three of them in preschool and in daycare all at the same time and have been spending $30,000 on their tuition. And my husband and I had really good salaries up until I lost my job recently. But we made the decision to keep our children in those full-time programs just because of the enrichment. And I know you've been talking a lot about, everything that the teachers can do for these children. And they are qualified. They are, you know, they love our children. They keep our children safe. And that's exactly what we want for them. And so for us, it was a financial stretch. But, you know, everything that they could get with their Spanish, their swimming, it was everything that we couldn't provide on a day-to-day basis. So we did make the sacrifice. But it was more than our mortgage.
Wow.
And thankfully, we, you know, we go through the YMCA, and we love that organization because they do provide financial aid.
Okay.
And, you know, without that, I don't think we would be able to give our children, you know, those advantages. And, you know, like your, you know, the experts have been saying, you know, we are starting out our family, and we haven't had 18 years to save for this. So it was just a really helpful thing. And some organizations may have, and we're very thankful that our Y does offer that.
Thank you so much for the call to Radio Times, Haley. So Bridget, you know, the Y apparently offers some sort of aid. Is this common among daycare organizations?
You know, it really depends. You know, there are, as Hannah had mentioned, you know, there is one sort of government subsidy program to the Child Development Block Grant, and that does help low-income families. But again, really only covers one in six kids who are eligible. And there are some child care centers or even private providers that will offer some kind of assistance or financial aid. But it's really very spotty. It's a very patchwork kind of system. You know, and so that's really where it comes back to, you know, if you win the lottery and you're near a child care center that's progressive and helpful, that's great. If you're in a child care desert, there are plenty of places that there aren't child care centers or in-home centers or in-home child care options available.
I'm glad you mentioned child care deserts. Describe that for us. And where are these deserts located primarily?
Yeah, so the Center for American Progress has done some really interesting work looking at where childcare deserts are. You know, where there would be a lack of a really quality care available, and you know, it's not surprising in many rural areas. There's a lack of quality care in certain neighborhoods, particularly lower income neighborhoods. It's very difficult to find some quality care. So I do think that that's important to remember, is that it's a very, not only is it a broken system, it's a very spotty system.
Many low-income families are able to access Head Start and early Head Start, which is for infants. Hannah Matthews, has Head Start lived up to its promise of leveling the playing field for children facing disadvantage?
So absolutely. We have now decades of research on the Head Start program that began in the 60s on the outcomes for kids, that it really does support their growth and development into adulthood. We see kids that have participated in that program with better outcomes. But the issue here, which is not dissimilar from what we're talking about in childcare, is again a lack of funding. So for those kids that are lucky enough to benefit from Head Start, it's a great program. But Head Start nationally is serving only about half of eligible preschoolers. And the early Head Start program, which you mentioned, which is just critical to work with infants and toddlers during that really, really important time of development, that program reaches only about 7% of eligible children. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, we have programs in place. We just need to find the will to invest in them in order to be able to reach more families.
So describe for us, Hannah, what then might be facing the kids who are not able to access Head Start at that critical age.
Right. So when we're talking about children in low-income families, you know, first of all, whether or not they're in Head Start, whether they're in a preschool program or childcare or don't have access, they're somewhere during the day, right? Most parents are working for some amount of time. So what we know is that these kids are often not in enriching environments. They're not in environments that are supporting them to get those early skills. When we talk about early childhood development, we're talking about something that looks very different than what we think of with education, right? We're thinking about helping kids develop their social-emotional skills, learning the skills that will take them to be successful when they start school. And so when children, particularly in lower-income families, aren't getting those supports, they may be in settings that are actually doing the opposite, where they're, you know, not being supported in those ways. And we really worry then about what that looks like as they enter school and for their success in life later on. We need to make sure that kids are getting the supports that they need from the very beginning.
Got an email from Paula. when considering putting children in childcare, it's not just the burden of money, but time and commuting and odd school schedules as well. After considering the additional cost of commuting in time and gas and the cost of tuition and the need for flexibility in using a vacation time to handle sick days, I decided to stay at home. And Bridget Schulte, this is a story I'm sure you hear over and over again.
Yeah, we absolutely do. You know, it's really tough. I actually, because the stories, we hear them so often, it just, it's not only heartbreaking, but it's really infuriating. We really need to be thinking how we do not support our working families in this country. And, we, you know, we talk about being a country of family values. It's like, well, since who? Where did that even come from? We really are not living our values. We are making it very, very difficult for our families in the United States.
Hannah Matthews, do companies routinely offer child care benefits in 2019? And if so, what form do they generally take?
Not routinely. there certainly are some cases where businesses have stepped up to either provide child care for employees or to provide some subsidies or tax credits in that space. But, you know, if we think about, in fact, you know, it was just mentioned, all of the challenges in meeting the child care needs of families. So whether it's about the transportation issues, the distance, their preferences for certain providers, business-sponsored childcare probably isn't going to be a large share of the solution for childcare in this country. Parents may not want to commute on with their young children. They have different needs for where they want their childcare to be. So I think while we have some examples out there, we really have to be thinking on a much larger scale about reaching all of the kids. And, you know, we talked about this with low-income families that for low-wage workers, their schedules are changing day to day, week to week. They're working evenings, weekends. They're working multiple jobs. That means the child care solution has to be much bigger than depending on employers to be able to meet that need, because it's just not workable for low-wage parents.
So if you're – Bridget Schulte.
I was just going to chime in. You know, again, when we think about the cost of care, I think it's important for people to recognize that parents pay the bulk of the cost of the childcare system, more than 60% in the United States. The government plays, you know, around 40-some percent in these subsidies for really low-wage families. But corporations, businesses, philanthropy, you know, the companies who benefit from the labor of working parents, they pay less than 4% of the cost of care. So there's absolutely a role for corporate investment and creativity, a whole lot more than they're doing now. But as Hannah says, we can't just rely on the private sector to really fix an entire system.
Does change come from individual parents who are workers at, say, one company? Can you successfully lobby for change and not feel like you're unduly sticking your neck out? I mean, years ago, the attitude, at least from my perspective, was management, for the most part, doesn't want to know about issues away from work. Just make sure that somehow the job gets done. Is there a bit of a cultural shift happening in the workplace, Bridget?
Yeah. Yes and no, honestly. You know, that's such a tough question. I think that we have moved away from, say, when I first was a working mother, and then the question was like, well, are you going to go back to work, as if it were this choice? And we thought about these issues as sort of women's issues or mother's issues. I do feel like there's this, been a movement where we understand that these are fundamentally economic issues. You know, for instance, if we really supported our families and we really helped women stay in the workforce, you know, McKinsey, there's been a report that estimates we could add over $4 trillion annually in GDP. You know, so that's, we have to understand that we are, you know, that these are much bigger than just individual choices. And in terms of what's really going to make a difference for change, I think we've been waiting for parents for too long to be the ones to make this change. And it's really an unfair burden to put on them. I mean, these are the busiest times of your life. You're stressed out of your mind. You have no idea where you're going to find the money to pay for your childcare, if you can even afford childcare. So I don't think that I don't think it's fair to expect parents to be the ones to lead the charge, even though they're the ones that are bearing most of the burden, if you will. They're already strapped. I think we need visionary people in as policymakers to really see the bigger picture here, that this is what we're talking about is an investment. Everybody gets so hung up on the cost. Oh, if we invest in childcare, it's going to be so expensive, and you know how terrible that is. But if you look at other systems that have invested in Quebec, for instance, they have universal subsidized childcare, and they thought that maybe they'd get a little bit of return, like maybe 40% back on the investment. They ended up finding 100% return on investment. Their, you know, the subsidies actually cost nothing because more women are able to stay in the workforce. More parents are able to stay at work. And so then they have increased tax revenue. They have fewer families that rely on public assistance. So it's actually, if you can kind of break out of that kind of short-term thinking and think bigger, it actually ends up helping everyone. It's really part of an economic growth or economic security kind of question.
Hannah Matthews, at the beginning of the show, we talked about the fact that, you know, the women's movement, you know, was decades ago. And, you know, after that, of course, many women entered the workplace. But, you know, in Quebec and other developed countries, you do have quality child care options for working parents. No such governmental, you know, widespread support in the United States. Why not?
Well, that's a great question. I actually, you know, think that we may be moving towards changing that. I think that, I mean, absolutely, we have very little in our public policies that show support for working families. But I think there's a lot of momentum right now. We are hearing a lot about childcare. We heard it in the last presidential election. I think we're going to hear more and more about it as this one is coming. There has been bipartisan support on childcare and early education in Congress. And, you know, we're also hearing lots more conversation about paid family medical leave. So we haven't gotten there yet as a country, but I am absolutely optimistic that we are getting much, much closer. And I think just the reality of what you're hearing from callers, the amount of money they're spending on childcare, the statistics that we're hearing, we're at a point where we can't do nothing, right? So this is an issue that we have to tackle as a country.
And speaking of callers, we do have calls and comments coming in, but I do want to get to one of the major proposals ahead of 2020, the 2020 Democratic presidential election. Democratic candidate Elizabeth Warren says, you know, her words, in the wealthiest country on this planet, access to affordable and high-quality child care and early education should be a right. She's proposing universal child care. Hannah, what does this look like in a nutshell?
So we don't have a lot of details yet about the plan, but essentially what Senator Warren has proposed, as you say, it's universal access to affordable child care. And the idea is that unlike the our current program that I mentioned has never been fully funded, that we would actually see a level of investment in child care that would ensure that every family would be able to access quality child care at a level that's affordable, meaning that families contribute on a sliding fee scale. So lower income families would pay nothing or very little. And then there would be subsidies for families into the middle income families as well, moving up the income scale. I do want to say that Senator Warren is actually not the only presidential candidate to endorse the idea of a major child care expansion. And there's actually pending legislation in Congress now that every Senate presidential candidate, every Democratic candidate has signed on to as an original co-sponsor of the bill. Actually, Senator Casey in Pennsylvania is a big supporter. And this is called the Child Care for Working Families Act. This legislation, very similar to this idea, it would be a major expansion of child care assistance. It would support about 3 out of 4 children in this country. And again, making sure that families would have the resources to be able to access quality child care. And the way that we do that is both by bringing down the cost for parents, but also making sure that we're making investments in the quality of that workforce. So training, professional development, building the supply of child care, all of those pieces are part of these big plans.
And Bridget Schulte, I'd like to give you a chance to weigh in. The Child Care for Working Families Act, which is proposed by Senator Patty Murray, is there an appetite for this in Congress, in your view?
So I think, again, some of the points that Hannah made are really important to really be thinking about, is that, you know, we are talking about child care in a way, in a sort of in a very national way that we have never really talked about before, since 2016 being part of the presidential election. you know, Democrats have had a variety of bills, for different versions of supporting child care or trying to have more investment in or revolutionize the system. They typically haven't gone anywhere. You know, Democrats in the Senate are a minority at this point. If you look at who the co-sponsors are, they do tend to be Democrats. So it's hard to say what will, what will actually happen, if anything. In the House, it might be a different story. But again, the politics are such that there seems to be a growing bipartisan recognition that child care is a crisis and is a problem. You've even got, President Trump and his budget. He talked about it. Ivanka had a listening session in February. They've got a proposal to try to spur more innovation in the private sector with a kind of a one-time $1 billion investment. So where the difference is how you solve it. And I think it's a classic sticking point where you have Democrats wanting a more public investment, more of a recognition that this is a problem for all of us, and so we all need to look at a solution, and Republicans being much more interested in leaving it to the private sector or having some kind of smaller tax incentives, which is sort of like fixing the pothole in front of your house when you really need to build a superhighway.
Yeah. And Hannah, we've got about 30 seconds before the break, but you have to wonder ahead of 2020 whether Elizabeth Warren's proposal is going to get as much attention on the campaign trail as questions regarding her Native American heritage.
I think childcare is going to be a big topic for all of the candidates. There is a reason that policymakers on both sides are talking about it, and it's because they know that it is absolutely the conversation that families are having. So I think this is going to be a big conversation, not just for Senator Warren, but for all of the candidates that are out there. And I think the candidates are going to be wanting to find a childcare proposal. They're going to know that that's going to get them support.
All right. Hannah Matthews is with the Center for Law and Social Policy. Bridget Schulte, the Better Life Lab at New America. We're talking about child care and how we can make it better in the United States. And as promised, we'll get to some of your comments and calls as soon as we get back from the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are looking at why good daycare is so expensive and proposals to make it more affordable. We are joined by Bridget Schulte, director of the Better Life Lab at New America. She's also the author of Overwhelmed, How to Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. Hannah Matthews is deputy executive director of policy at the Center for Law and Social Policy. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. Is the number to call. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And we've heard from Tiana, who says, my family of five is a low-income family, and it is extremely hard to get financial assistance. Last year, we made $46,000, but some subsidy programs told us we made too much. Some said we made too little. Our children aren't in child care right now, and I do not know what to do. Bridget Schulte, Tiana's not alone. She's caught between a rock and a hard place. Tough situation. Where do you even begin?
Yeah, this is I think it's important to remember that there's an awful lot of Tianas out there. And is this really the situation we want to have our families in? Are these the choices we really want them to be facing? I think one of the things that's really important to remember that doesn't seem to we've forgotten, but we were here before. We actually had a bipartisan bill that passed both the House and the Senate in the early 1970s that would have provided universal child care, high quality, affordable on a sliding scale, easily accessible. There were polls that showed there was vast public support. There was an understanding that working parents were becoming more of the norm and that we as a nation needed to support our families. With public investment, government subsidized investment, it was sort of a no-brainer. Nixon was the president at the time. He even had some of his, at the time it was the Health, Education, and Welfare Department. He had one of his staffers working on crafting the legislation. there was this recognition that these 0 to 5 years were critical. And so we needed, if we wanted to really invest in the future and have a real, economic opportunity for all our children, we really needed this. And it was, I think that's really important. We've forgotten, we've been here before. We did this before. And what happened in the White House, there was the a rise of the much more conservative element of the Republican Party. Pat Buchanan was a speechwriter. He had just returned from a trip to the Soviet Union. If you remember, this was the height of the Cold War. And he was totally freaked out by what he saw. And he saw this child care bill and he thought, oh, my God, it's going to turn the United States into the Soviet Union. Mm. And he convinced Richard Nixon to veto the bill. Pat Buchanan then wrote the veto message. And I went and I spoke with him for my book. I wanted to try to understand. I went to him like, you made life miserable for so many American parents. Why did you do that? And he said, we wanted to kill not only that bill, but the idea of child care in the United States. Because in America, mom should be home with cake and pie at 3 o'clock when the kids come home from school. Mm. Well, I hate to tell Pat Buchanan, but, you know, moms are not home at 3 with cake and pie when kids get home from school. Or if we had more flexible work, maybe they could be. But the bottom line is a vast majority of our parents work. The majority of children in the United States are being raised in families where all parents work, whether it's a dual income family or a single parent family. So we've been here before, and we know how to do this. And unfortunately, the whole debate got sidetracked by this kind of Cold War fear. And when I asked Pat Buchanan, it's like, well, how did you and your family deal with child care? He told me, we never had children. Hmm. So you have somebody that's completely derailed policy for millions of families who just didn't understand what families go through. I think now is the time to really think differently about it.
Before we move on, I'd like Hannah Matthews, if you could weigh in on Tiana's question. You can't help but feel awful for her and concerned that she's stuck.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, she's one of millions. What happens in our current system is that because we are not fully funding it, states make all kinds of choices and trade-offs. And one of the choices they make is often to limit who can get help. So we end up serving the poorest families first, lower income families, whereas this is a subsidy program that was designed to support families up into their, as they grow in income, to be able to go to work, to have childcare, and to improve their economic circumstance. And so we really are shortchanging Tiana and others when we're not helping families be able to move forward economically, right? We're not helping them with that economic stability, and that hurts our kids in the long run.
It doesn't. This doesn't help Tiana move forward immediately, but you know, for the long run, don't hesitate to call your state and federal lawmaker.
Just jump in on that? Because we talked about momentum in Congress, which I think is really exciting, but there also is a lot happening locally and in states. And I just want to mention, because actually in Pennsylvania, there's quite a lot of work going on. There's a Start Strong campaign to make infant toddler care more affordable. There's a Pre-K for Pennsylvania campaign that's looking at high-quality pre-K for 3 and 4-year-olds. So I would just give a shout-out, Public Citizens for Children and Youth, PCCY. If you go to their website or their Facebook page, there are lots of ways that individuals can get involved. So absolutely, we should be calling members of Congress and should be working on this locally as well.
Email from Pamela. I'm surprised that none of your guests have mentioned the possibility that staying home with a loving parent can be the best and most enriching experience for a young child. And no doubt, but again, for many families, there's no choice. Correct, Bridget?
Well, I think that she makes a good point. And I think that they don't have to be two mutually exclusive things. You know, if you have a good functioning childcare system, you also want to have families have the choice about whether to use it or not, or whether to make the choice that it makes sense to have a parent at home. I think that's nobody's saying that everybody should work. And I think that's the important thing to recognize. We want families to be able to make the right choice for themselves. And have a system that works for everybody. And I think that So many families are not able to make those kinds of choices, that they would rather work or they would rather have economic security, and they're not able to afford it. But, you know, there are some other countries that, to that very point, part of their universal child care system does have an allowance for parents who choose to stay home. So I think that we're not even talking about something like that. You know, I think Warren has not ruled that out. She had mentioned it in an earlier book of hers, but that could be part of the conversation as well. You know, it's really about how do you enable families to make real choices, the best choices. But if you do that, and if you enable parents to, you know, to if you give them some kind of help so that they are able to make that choice to stay home, then you really need to look at our work systems and how are you going to help that parent then get back into work without suffering a huge penalty.
Okay. According to information from the National Bureau of Economic Research, men and women earn similar amounts until the birth of their first child. Then the woman's earnings plunge. The fact is, if an adult must stay at home with the children, it's still most often mom as opposed to dad. Hannah Matthews, what do you think?
Well, there are lots of reasons that we still see an enormous pay gap between women and men. I also want to add in a piece here that we haven't talked as much, which is really a racial equity component of this, that when we look across earnings, we also know that many of these low-income women who we're talking about who are earning less are also women of color. And so we have a real need to address that issue of equity as well within this. But absolutely, we don't have supports in place for working families. And it is often women that bear the brunt of that in terms of earnings. But we need to be thinking about this as a support for all families and making sure that, as the last caller alluded to, that families have the choices. And right now, there are just not choices for families.
And taking time off can affect what? Work skills, contacts. Bridget, tell me more.
Yeah. Well, just think about it. Our work system, the way our work, you know, is organized and structured is like everything else. You know, it's still based on this idea that we have these 1950s families where there's one earner who goes up to work and can work nonstop until they drop of a heart attack 40 years later. And then somebody else is supposedly staying at home and taking care of everything at home, that kind of breadwinner homemaker ideal that, frankly, you know, was really only available to middle and upper middle income families. You know, for many families of color, they've always had working parents. You know, so we are sort of stuck in this nostalgic view that somehow that's the best way to be an American family, even though in the 1950s, that's not really how all families were. But when you have a workplace that still is organized around that idea, you know, it's one of the reasons we don't have paid family and medical leave. We still expect the worker to be this kind of ideal worker from the 1950s. You know, our workplaces haven't adjusted the way that our workforce has changed. And so, you know, if you do take time out for caring for your children, it is very difficult to get back in. You do lose a lot. You lose skills. You lose contacts. You lose the ability to come back in and continue to have an upward trajectory. It's not to say it doesn't happen. It certainly does. And if you have higher wages, higher income, more resources, you know, you're more likely and more able to do it. But it really is very difficult. Again, we make it really difficult.
Reading a couple of tweets, Pablo says in 2018, we spent $21,000 on child care. They didn't even provide lunch. Then from Heather, the child care system should also consider how employers are not obligated to support families and caregivers. The Netherlands is a model country for a child care system that makes sure employers allow for all to be involved in the workforce and meet the needs of the family. Hannah Matthews, you see that translating to the U.S.?
I think public investments are where we need to go. And I think that's both about making sure that we have policies that, through employers, support working families. We've talked about paid family medical leave, paid sick days. There are lots of supports that we need to think about making sure that parents who are in the workforce have access to. But fundamentally, to be able to get to the level of investment that we need to raise the quality of child care and to make it affordable for families, that's going to be a public investment.
I'd like to get to one more proposal on the national stage. A Democratic presidential candidate, Julian Castro, as mayor of San Antonio, He led the charge to implement full-day pre-K in that city. He now wants to take this concept nationwide, calling it pre-K for the USA. Bridget Schulte, do you think there's the political appetite for something like this?
Well, you know, I do feel like, especially in recent years, there's been a lot more discussion at the local level, even at the national level, for pre-K, for investment in pre-K. There's sort of like this understanding that really to be ready for kindergarten, to be ready for school, that you really do need that high-quality child care. That does seem to be much more palatable. You've got different states who are doing very creative things around universal child care, states like Oklahoma and Georgia. So I do feel like that is more politically palatable. There's an awful lot more bipartisan as well as business buy into that. So the real critical stage that we need to be talking about is 0 to 3. You know, we don't have paid family medical leave in this country. I think people need to stop thinking about it as some kind of benefit or perk or entitlement. The workforce has changed. A majority of mothers work. Half of our workforce is women. That is what we have that is what drives the economic engine of our country. So how do we match our policies and our practices to really meet the needs of that workforce? You know, the majority of women in the United States go back to work before a baby can hold its head up. You know, we talk about infants going to childcare at 6 weeks. Most other countries have paid family medical leave, and that's how they deal with infant care. Yeah. That's how you deal with those high costs, as one of the other callers said. You know, invest in that time so that parents can develop those strong bonds and relationships, so that by the time a child does go to childcare, if that's the choice of the family, they're much older and they're much much more able to do that. A woman has been able to have time to recover in her body and is more able to re-enter the workforce. We need to be thinking about this in a much larger way, really from zero to eight. Those are critical years.
And worth noting, back to pre-K for just a moment, there is a locally funded program in Philadelphia which serves, I think it's about 3,000 children, 3- and 4-year-olds, and funded by the soda tax. And of course, that's, you know, the beverage industry is still pushing against that. But I just wanted to get that in. Hannah, you were going to say?
Sure. So I think, you know, pre-K is absolutely a part of this conversation. But I think it's really important to remember that, first of all, even as we've seen progress across states and localities on pre-K, we're still, you know, not reaching a majority of kids in most of those places. But what we're talking about is a program for 4-year-olds, in some cases for 3-year-olds. And we're often talking about part day programs or a school day. Now, you know, working parents can't pick their kids up at the end of the school day. So, you know, we have to think about kids at all ages. As Bridget said, infants and toddlers really important. We also haven't talked about school age care, which is another critical need, right? I have two kids in elementary school, and they can't watch themselves after school or on school vacation. So we have to be thinking about the full spectrum, not just our 4-year-olds. And that's why we have to think about pre-K in the context of a larger child care system.
And nuts and bolts thing here, Hannah Matthews, for the grade school child, finding coverage for summer months can be a huge challenge. Options?
It is a challenge. I mean, here, too, it's we see the same thing, right? There is a patchwork of programs. So in some communities, you have programs that are subsidized that families can access at low or no cost. In other places, you have families paying an exorbitant amount of money or, you know, doing that shuffle, going from one neighbor to a family member and kind of patching it together. It looks the same as our larger childcare system. It's just a concentrated time for families that is very, very challenging.
The ways to go. Stay tuned. Hannah Matthews, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hannah Matthews is Deputy Executive Director of Policy at the Center for Law and Social Policy. And Bridget Schulte, our thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bridget Schulte is director of the Better Life Lab at New America. And as always, don't forget to join us on social media and check out our podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us for Radio Times.